Hello, this is Terrence McNally. I'm recording this intro on Labor Day 2022, which seems a good time to honor and remember Barbara Ehrenreich, author of more than 20 books, who died September 1st at the age of 81. In her bestseller Nickel and Dime, she explored the lives of low-wage workers. And here's my 2005 conversation with Ehrenreich, in which we talk about her follow-up, Bait and Switch, in which she examined the lives of white-collar unemployed. Here are a couple of quotes. The first from Barbara: "I have never seen a conflict between journalism and activism. As a journalist, I search for the truth, but as a moral person, I'm also obliged to do something about it." And the second from her son, writer Ben Ehrenreich: "She was never much for thoughts and prayers, but you can honor her memory by loving one another and by fighting like hell." In the second half, you'll hear my 2009 conversation with one of Latin America's most beloved literary figures, Eduardo Galeano, who passed away in 2015. His many books include The Open Veins of Latin America and Mirrors, Stories of Almost Everyone. Hello, I'm Terry McNally. Welcome to Free Forum. Who gets left behind in our society these days? In the aftermath of Katrina, we've all seen that the very poor pay dearly for their poverty. But they're not the only ones. In her impactful, best-selling book, Nickel and Dimed, Barbara Ehrenreich explored the lives of low-wage workers, those working one or more jobs and still struggling to survive. Now in her new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, Ehrenreich looks at another hidden realm of the economy, the white-collar unemployed. In her earlier book, she worked in the trenches at a restaurant and a Walmart. In this one, armed with a plausible resume of a professional in transition, she attempts to land a middle-class job and fails. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of 13 books, including Blood Rights, Origins, and History of the Passions of War, as well as Nickel and Dimed and Bait and Switch. She's a frequent contributor to the New York Times, Harper's, The Progressive, and Time magazine. Welcome, Barbara Ehrenreich, to KPFK and Free Forum.
I'm glad to be with you.
Thank you very much. I want listeners to get to know the people behind the work and the ideas that we deal with in the show. So let me ask you, how did you become a writer? And how do you choose your subjects?
Well, I didn't choose to become a writer. At a certain point in my life, in my 20s, I was an activist. And I was working with a group. We worked on advocating better health care for low-income people in New York City, where I had to do a lot of writing for our newsletter and a lot of investigative pieces. And I enjoyed it. So I thought, well, this is something I can do and I like to do. It was a while, though, before it occurred to me that I might actually, get paid for it. Not much, but, to step into defining myself as a freelance writer. That took a while longer. How do I choose my topics? Well, I guess there are really two forces pushing me one way or another. One is anger, indignation, outrage, whatever happens to be going on at the time. But the other is curiosity. I will admit that is a major factor, that I will get interested in something and become obsessed with trying to get an answer.
Okay, and if we look at, as I said, in Nickel and Dimed, a book that was quite a phenomenon, you got hired and worked in various of those jobs that are at the very end of the job scale. In the new book, Bait and Switched, when you set out to write it, was this supposed to be a book about looking for a white-collar job or holding one down?
I wasn't sure. There was one thing motivating me, and that is that I was getting so many letters from people who had read Nickel and Dimed and found themselves in a similar situation, but who had college degrees, often higher degrees than that, who had once held decent-paying white-collar jobs, but then lost their jobs in some sort of downsizing or outsourcing or right-sizing or reorging or whatever the euphemism might be, and then found themselves in a spiral they could not stop that went all the way down to the $7 or $8 an hour level. So this made me think, well, what's going on here? This is something I want to investigate. I won't feel that I have really understood what is happening with poverty in the United States if I don't look more into these somewhat unexpected people and their falls down to poverty.
Tell people just a little bit, if you will, of what you did and how it worked out, and then we'll look at the implications.
Well, I decided to investigate in the same way that I had done Nickel and Dimed. Well, I mean, there was a lot of reading and conventional kinds of research, too, but I decided to put myself in the position of a white-collar professional looking for a corporate job and, you know, just physically enter that world, whatever it was. I hoped to get a job. I had a very good resume as a PR person. There was nothing in it I couldn't actually do. And I hoped to hold a job and look at things from the inside, too. However, my experience was more typical, was more like that of most unemployed white-collar people. I looked for 10 months, and nothing that I would actually call a real job came along.
Okay, I think just to be totally accurate, you did in 10 months of making this your primary work was finding a job, correct?
That's right.
You got two offers?
Do we have to get right away to that? yes. Well, you know, I want to throw in that I did everything. You know, the rule I set for myself was that I would do whatever it took. And that meant putting out a lot of money for career coaches, traveling to networking meetings, going to a job seeker's boot camp, going to job fairs, just doing everything you can possibly do. And of course, posting my resume on all the major internet job boards, going to corporate internet sites, applying for jobs directly there, making the follow-up calls. I mean, this is a job.
That's right. And it's also expensive. In other words, had you not had savings, this would have put what kind of a dent on someone's credit card, someone who is suddenly out of work?
Well, I spent about $6,000
okay.
on the job search.
So nothing's coming
in.
It's
possible to spend a whole lot more, though. I take some of the possibilities that involved, you know, they would coach you, they would give you the right contacts for an initial fee of about $4,000 and then another $4,000 at the end. That just seemed to me more than I was willing to invest.
But you did put out $6,000
yes.
for some of these coaches and sessions
yes.
and so on.
Yes. And I had a makeover.
Oh.
I became corporate looking.
Uh-huh. As a matter of fact,
I
think I read one review that said you didn't change the lapel pin.
That was a mistake. That may be where I went wrong, the lapel pin.
And so, again, you finally did, after all of this work, time, investment, and so on, you did get a couple of offers, but...
Well, yes. One, you know, my first real resume, my first real interview, I was thrilled. I was so excited. I suited up in my full corporate gear and went for the interview. Well, it turned out this was to sell supplemental health insurance with Aflac,
mm-hmm.
the company with the annoying duck commercials.
Yes, yes.
And I said I didn't want to be a salesperson. I was a PR person, but I would manage other salespeople. Well, it doesn't work like that. You know, you have to kind of recruit your own people to manage, sort of make your own team.
So you were allowed to manage if you could find people that wanted you to manage
exactly.
them.
Exactly. And so I said, well, naively I asked, is there health insurance? No, even though you'd be selling it. I said, what's the pay? None. Only whatever commissions you can make.
Ah.
And I said, well, where will I be based at? Where's my office? None. So what? I don't call that a job.
That's true. They weren't putting themselves at risk,
no,
were they?
Nobody would take a risk on me. And the other offer, equally, you know, unrewarding, was to sell cosmetics with Mary Kay.
Uh-huh. And which is not.
I guess it says something to how well I looked
right.
in my corporate outfit that I was even offered this position. But again, no pay, no health insurance. No, nothing. And in both of these instances, you had to put up about $2,000 to even get started.
Hmm.
And No.
Okay. Okay, let me tell people that you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming on the web at www.kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally. I'm speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich, author of the bestseller Nickel and Dimed, about her newest book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. You can learn more at www.barbaraehrenreich.com, which you do have to know how to spell, and that the it's one word, and the Ehrenreich is E-H-R-E-N-R-E-I-C-H. Okay, let's shift to the lessons you took from this. Who do you think is responsible, if anyone, for the plight? A, there's the increasing number of people who've worked all their lives and suddenly find themselves out of a job, and then the fact that it's much harder than even you imagined to find yourself back in one. Is this a natural consequence of globalization, or what's the role of the corporation, the government, the individual, our culture?
Well, as far as I can answer that, there was a seismic shift in corporate culture in the 90s, away from the idea of the corporation as a large unit of people trying to do something together, sell a product, make money, to something much stranger. The fad became, in the mid-90s, downsizing, eliminating as many people as possible, being as lean as possible. We almost take that for granted now. That was not the attitude before. Once there was more of a mutual loyalty between certainly the white-collar people and the higher-ups, the corporation, now that loyalty is completely gone. People are seen as disposable resources. So there's constant churning in and out of the white-collar corporate world. The first few times may not be so bad. You may land in a new job. You may do okay, though statistically you're likely to see your income drop with each change. Eventually, when you get past 40 or certainly 45, you're unlikely to get back in if you're in this kind of middle level.
Let me ask two quick questions or observations, make observations about that. One is, of course, now we have longer lifespan, and yet people can really be off the what used to be a lifetime track, as you say, by the middle 40s. Second is, often if they believe that a younger person with less seniority will be willing to do what you were doing for less money, that's enough for you to be out on the street, isn't it?
Yeah, and the perverse thing is that a lot of people being picked off from their jobs are precisely the people who have achieved the most. Because if you achieve, in many cases, you get rewarded with a promotion or higher pay, and that in itself makes you a tempting cost cut to some bean cutter in the corporation. So they say, oh, let's get rid of her. She's making $70,000 a year, and we can hire a 23-year-old. We can work twice as hard, maybe, if that's even possible, and pay half as much. So it's not the losers that are being skimmed off. It's often the high achievers who are being tossed out.
Okay, and one of the things that I know just from working as a consultant myself and talking with other folks is that what often gets lost in that case is not just the personal loses, but the corporation, the organization, loses their history.
Well, that's a good point. And you do have to wonder, as many management consultants have pointed out, what happens as you have more and more work being done by a smaller number of people who are both exhausted and insecure, and they're not the most experienced people.
Exactly. And so they may have a few more high-tech skills they learn playing video games, but there's more to working as part of a team than that. If you had time to think about it, which you have since you were on this search, if you hadn't had a writer's career to fall back on, you would be in dire straits. When you have thought about it, we joked a little bit about the lapel pin. Why do you think you couldn't get hired? And how generalizable do you think that is?
I don't know how generalizable my experience is. I'm certainly over 45, and I didn't have a Rolodex full of corporate contacts as I might have had if I had had the life I was claiming to have had. But, I saw a lot of younger people who did have the contacts searching for a year or more, 2 years, whatever. So I don't know. I did have some advantages. I am a good writer, and that, I hope, showed up in my cover letters. I have a lot of self-confidence in, you know, meeting people. I have, you know, some of the things the career coaches are always urging on you, although I'm not sure I had the appropriately upbeat, positive, perky look at all times. I tried. So I'd say my experience of looking for 10 months is not unusual.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that no matter how perky you start out with in your first or second month, it may be a lot. There must be an awful lot of feigned perkiness by the time people are in their sixth, seventh month of looking for a job.
Yeah.
Because it is a important theme in the book, this thing that you just mentioned about the perkiness, the positive attitude, and so on. What is, and now we're going to shift into sort of the underlying lessons here. What's going on there? In other words, what does that happen? What happens to our culture when that feigned perkiness is fairly widespread? What are they telling you there?
Well, part of what they're telling you implicitly with all that is that it's really your fault. That if your attitude is good enough, if you beam out positive thoughts to the universe, everything will go well. And if you, you know, have lost a job or something, must have been something wrong with your, quote, personality or your attitude. So you're constantly urged to work on yourself. These coaches and these boot camps and so on, nobody lets you talk about the economy or the market. You have to all focus on this new agey self, what should I say, self-improvement work. What does it do to us as a culture when everybody is trying to put on a smiley face? I don't know, but I think we're not professional actors.
Mm-hmm.
That's asking a lot of people.
Right.
And I think but that's what they emphasize, that the way to get a job is not to have a great resume, but to be, quote, likable.
Mm-hmm. So let me take that broader and say it appears that we're told now that we will only elect, that the U.S. culture will only elect an optimist as president. We're told that people don't want to hear about what's wrong. They want to hear about what's right. We're not allowed to see the dead bodies come back from Iraq. We're told by the administration we're not supposed to place blame now after Katrina. We're just supposed to move on and be positive. Is there a link here?
Well, one link I've been thinking about a lot in the last week is that when you're making job choice, it's selecting employees on the basis of likability and who they know rather than what they can do. You get Michael Brown,
mm-hmm,
heading up FEMA. You get a culture of incompetence. And yet, that seems to be the way it works. I mean, look at the insistence on networking as the way to get a job, as opposed to, you know, applying, et cetera. What that says is it's not who you are, it's who you know.
Mm-hmm.
And how you can impress people with your smile and your outfit and so on in a fleeting meeting and a get-together. That's not how you pick competent people. I think we accept a culture of incompetence and cronyism, not just in the government, but in the corporate world.
Mm-hmm, right. That it isn't that Michael Brown is not the exception. It's just Katrina is.
Yeah.
You're listening to Free Forum, KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming on the web at www.kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally, speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich, author of the phenomenal bestseller Nickel and Dimed. We're talking about her new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. You can learn more about these books. You can find reprints of her articles and so on at www.barbaraehrenreich.com. Let me move much broader and talk about Katrina and talk about the United States. I would hope that Katrina is, for this country, a teachable moment. And one of the thoughts that I have had is that if you look at Katrina and you look at the aftermath, you look at the preparation and you look at the aftermath, that I think we see certainly incompetence. There may be, you know, there's lots of other things you can say, callousness, lack of empathy, et cetera, et cetera. But incompetence, I think, is the most crucial piece here. And as I look at it, I think it is too simple to place the blame at the administration, at the right, at the Republicans, at George Bush, at Chertoff, at Brown. That basically, and I know this is a big setup, but I'm giving you an opportunity for a long answer here. I used to say before the November election that if Bush won, we would not be able to say that this was these were Bush's deficits or this was Bush's war. That if America reelected him, whether we like it or not individually, it's America's deficits, America's war. This is America's preparation for Katrina and America's aftermath. So what I'm saying is I don't think it's enough to blame the administration. I think that there's something really wrong with both parties and with the whole system that we can't seem to even be competent if we're the administration in power or be competent enough to win elections if the party out of power. I would say if you want this kind of thing not to happen again, we've got to actually restore a functioning democracy to this country. Your thoughts?
Well, that's a big, big setup, as you said. I think I'm completely with you. Yes, and it goes beyond. It's not just Republicans. We could find some of the same cronyism and corporate attachments and everything within the Democrats. I think, you know, we've all been shaken. I've been terribly shaken by Katrina. I thought we were better able to respond to something like this. And it shows we have let government fall apart, really. We have let it decay. We've had, you know, ever since Clinton talking about, you know, the era of big government is over, we've had big government in the form of military spending, but very small government when it comes to helping people. And that, you know, I don't want to trivialize this to, by bringing it around to, again, the fate of the laid-off white-collar folks, but there, too, there's no safety net. You don't have health insurance once you lose your job. Unemployment insurance is inadequate, and it lasts only 6 months. We seem to have let that part of government that represents some kind of mutual assistance and reaching out to others, we've let that decay. And so when we are hit by something terrible, even if it's an individual thing like an illness that comes on top of being laid off, or whether it's a mega disaster like Katrina, there's nothing there.
And the media, let me give you one last final question. As a member of the media, if not the daily media, the media finally seemed to show some spine, some nerve, some sense of reality as they began to show their own personal feelings and insist for some accuracy. Someone would say one thing, an official would say some sort of spin, and they would say, but that's not true, something I have not seen them do. In almost every other case for the last several years, do you see any hope of spine lasting?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, I think the scandal is right in our faces. There's no avoiding it. There's no avoiding the horrible stain of racism that runs through this lack of response. I'd like to think that everybody is as shaken and shocked as I am and as, eager to see very fundamental change.
Okay. We'll leave it at that for now, Barbara. I certainly hope that we can do this again sometime in the future. Let me tell people, the new book is Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, and you can learn more about that and Barbara's other work at www.barbaraehrenreich.com, and Aaron Reich is EHRENREICH. Thank you to Zubri Fields, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi, Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic. I look forward to being with you again next week. In the meantime, email me at TEMcNally@att.net. That's one word, TEMcNally at att.net. If you have questions or comments, if you'd like CDs of past shows, or if you'd like to be on my weekly announce list telling you who we're talking to and what we're going to talk about, you can listen to Free Forum with Terry McNally on KPFK 90.7 FM for Southern California and KPFK.org on the web. Thank you, Barbara Ehrenreich, and keep up your good work.
It's been a pleasure talking with you, Terrence.
This is Terrence McNally. Barbara Ehrenreich died September 1st at the age of 81. In the second half, you'll hear my 2009 conversation with Eduardo Galeano, essayist, journalist, historian, activist, and one of Latin America's most beloved literary figures. His many books include The Memory of Fire Trilogy, The Open Veins of Latin America, and Mirrors, Stories of Almost Everyone. Galeano died in 2015. Hello, I'm Terry McNally, and welcome to KPFK and Free Forum. Today, it is my privilege to have as my guest one of Latin America's most acclaimed writers, Eduardo Galeano. Let me begin with a confession. I was not aware of him until Hugo Chavez presented Barack Obama with one of his books. For that introduction, I thank the Venezuelan president. Galeano's works are a unique blend of history, fiction, journalism, and political analysis, and his life is so much more than that. Born in Uruguay in 1940, Eduardo Galeano began writing newspaper articles as a teenager. By the age of 20, he became editor-in-chief of La Marcha. A few years later, he took the top post at Montevideo's daily newspaper, Época. At 31, he wrote his most famous book, Chavez's Gift, The Open Veins of Latin America, 5 Centuries of the Pillage of a Continent. After the 1973 military coup in Uruguay, Galeano was imprisoned and forced to leave the country. He settled in Argentina, where he founded and edited a cultural magazine, Crisis. After the 1976 military coup there, he moved to Spain, where he began his classic work, Memory of Fire, a 3-volume narrative of the history of America, North and South. He eventually returned home to his native Uruguay, where he now lives. His latest book is called Mirrors, Stories of Almost Everyone. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, and culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Welcome, Eduardo Galeano, to KPFK and Free Forum.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I really thank you for this opportunity. I always say that I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. So, as I said, journalist, editor, poet, author, activist. In a very brief way, how do you see your path to what you're doing today? How do you define yourself?
I don't know. I have no definition. I hate definitions, you know, because it's like a label, you know, the glue in your front.
A barcode.
Yeah, something like a barcode. And in our world, in our times, there is this obsession of classifying people, no? And perhaps it's not so innocent. I mean, perhaps it's something useful for collective manipulation. And I don't want to be classified because my literature, what I write, is absolutely unclassifiable. Fortunately enough, it's a synthesis of all the genres. And I'm proud of it because I like violating frontiers and the frontiers between literary genres are for me as hateful, as horrible as any other frontier. For instance, the frontier separating, divorcing the body and the soul, as I was trained to accept in my Catholic childhood, or the frontier separating the mind and the heart. That's why I took from the fishermen in Colombia, in the coast of Colombia, a very beautiful word, a very beautiful expression. They invented it to define the language able to express the truth, which is senti pensante, which means feel thinking.
Feel thinking.
Feel thinking in a single word.
One word.
Yeah, invented by the fishermen. I was just I took from them, and I always quote them as a true authors, but I use it because I think we should recover a feel thinking way of saying and a feel thinking way of living.
Having said that, I during the course of this
fairly brief interview, I do want you to read some of the stories, the selections in Mirrors, and that is a very good introduction, I think, to writing No.
Yeah. Afterwards, if there is another story called Writing Yes. Because
you want to read them both? Read them both.
No, because I do believe in the art of writing, but this is a story interesting, at least, no? As all the stories in the book, it comes from reality. It's a real story. I didn't invent it. Some 5,000 years before Champollion, the god Thoth traveled to Thebes, Tebas, and offered King Thammuz of Egypt the art of writing. He explained hieroglyphs and said that writing was the best remedy for poor memory and feeble knowledge. The king refused the gift. Memory? Knowledge? This invention will encourage forgetting. Knowledge resides in truth, not in its appearance. One cannot remember with the memory of another. Men will record, but they will won't recall. They will repeat, but they will not leave. They will learn of many things, but they won't understand a thing. It was a terrible prophecy of our days, no?
Yeah.
About the means of communication, the so-called media and so on, not only, but it began being a myth, a legend, about the art of writing.
The way I read it was that he's in a virginal state with regard to writing. He experiences things in the moment. All he has is what happens each moment. And he realizes that writing will separate us from the actual experience.
Yes, which is true. But writing has been also the way we human found to avoid the fading action of the wind of time. It was something like our human right to remember, even if, as that God said, it's impossible to remember with some other one's memory. But thanks to this art of writing, we now may read the first love poem ever written in human history, which was written in Sumeria, in Iraq, the invaded country, where the art of writing was invented. It was not invented in Texas, it was invented in Iraq. And if the first love poem was written there in several tablets, at that time, that was the way that books were kept, written in mud, and later the fire made it possible that thousands of years after we may read them. Fortunately enough, this poem, love poem, was not destroyed during the invasion. A lot of other masterworks of Sumerian and Babylonian literature were lost. But fortunately enough, the poem not. And for me, it was a challenge because the book mirrors this book we are speaking about. It doesn't contain transcriptions, long transcriptions, only by exception. And the poem is really long. So I was obliged it was a challenge to say it in few lines, two, three lines, what the poem was.
To capture the essence of the whole poem in very few.
Yeah, the essence is that the poem told the encounter of a shepherd and a goddess, and they loved each other during one night, and during that night the goddess became mortal and the shepherd was immortal until the end of that night.
Let me just tell people that I'm Terry McNally. This is Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM. And I'm speaking with Eduardo Galeano. He's one of the most acclaimed writers of Latin America. And his book, The Veins of...
Open Veins
of Latin America, was the gift from Hugo Chavez to Barack Obama. And the book mirrors stories of almost everyone, is his most recent gift to all of us, and we are dealing with that.
Open Veins was the first stage in a long road in Mirrors is not the last, I hope, but the most recent.
But Mirrors is really ambitious, and when I first read what it was, it's 600 short selections, as you can tell, because he's read one, and it, you know, half a page, many of them. And I thought, you know, I didn't know what to think. And as I read it, I just fell in love with it. And I thought, this is something I would give a young person to get a history, an anthropology, a political history, a sociology, you know, all of this in one book gathered from everywhere. How did you choose to do something so ambitious?
Well, you know, books write me. I don't really write them. They begin growing inside. At the beginning, it was one short story, two, three, five. I didn't know it would become a book. I wrote the stories just for the pleasure of recovering lost memories. That's the sense that the book may have, to help us to rebuild the human rainbow in all its splendor, in all its beauty. And this rainbow has been mutilated by the machismo who deleted half of humanity from official memory, all women, by racism, who also condemned to oblivion the black people and black cultures in Africa entirely. It was so important, Africa. It's one of our mothers. All from the northern part of the Americas up to the southern part, Africa has always had some influence. The footprint of their cultures is in our way of cooking, dancing, singing, sculpturing, doing art, everywhere. And what do we know about Africa? Nothing. Nothing at all. Only what Professor Tarzan taught us. And he never was in Africa, as you know. He was the invention of a retired functionary of the British Railway, with a man of talent indeed, but he was never in Africa.
Wow. Let me ask you to read another one then from Mirrors.
Yes.
And because you were mentioning how we wrote out half of them, let me see, the one I want is, oh shoot, I'll tell you what, let me have you read this one, which I think is very prophetic, How Could We? It speaks so much to our current predicament.
Yes. How could we? To be mouth or mouthful? Boca o bocado? Hunter or hunted? Cazador o cazado? That was the question. We deserved scorn, or at most, pity. In the hostile wilderness, no one respected us. No one feared us. We were the most vulnerable beasts in the animal kingdom, terrified of night and the jungle, useless as youngsters, not much better as adults, without claws or fangs or nimble feet or keen sense of smell, nothing. Our earliest history is lost in mist. It seems all we ever did was break rocks and beat each other with clubs. But one might well ask, weren't we able to survive when survival was all but impossible because we learned to share our food and band together for defense? Would today's me first do your round thing, sálvese quien pueda, civilization have lasted more than a single moment?
Yeah. I think that's so wonderful because it basically goes back to the root. How did we survive? And it was only our ability, our solidarity, which we now sacrifice.
This is came just from common sense. I never read it before, but it's an act of common sense. It was impossible. We were so vulnerable. When you compare our babies, recently born babies, with babies coming from other families of animals, it's unbelievable that this baby, completely unable, completely even to walk, to everything, could survive. Only if this baby, our ancestor, had been able to build some solidarity web to protect him or her. And without solidarity, we would not be alive here on Earth. No? This is something coming from common sense and a good source for optimism when you are tempted to think that human condition is doomed to violence and we are obliged to go on exterminating each other because we have this killing instinct inside. And well, perhaps it's true, but we have other instincts inside, fortunately.
Yeah. And as we see, the current financial crisis brought on, where the whole world suffers for the greed and the complete lack of solidarity of a few, 500, 1,000, something like that.
It's unbelievable, the results of this crisis, no? The fact that they are being rewarded. I mean, the responsible of this gamble, and now the entire world is suffering the consequences, are being rewarded. It's like Robin Hood, but upside down. Hood Robin. I mean, the stealing the poor to give to the rich. It would be that story told.
Absolutely.
Now, no? And that's why I had the idea with some friends, we were all drunk, to begin a campaign, a charity campaign, and an international campaign, with the slogan, Adopt a Banker.
What was the first word?
Adopt a Banker.
Adopt a Banker.
Adopt a Banker.
I'm speaking with Eduardo Galeano. He's been writing for many, many years. His classic, The Open Veins of Latin America, was the book Hugo Chavez gave to Obama. It's a history of pillage for five centuries.
Yes. For me, it was a port of departure, not a port of arrival. Right. And I wrote it almost 40 years ago.
You were 31.
Yes, and at that, 29 years old at that time, and I really, I'm very proud of this book, but afterwards, I think I could walk on.
Once you got that out of the way, then you could.
Along the road, open veins, and I wrote other books, and I think this one, the last one, is my best, Mirrors.
Yes, and I recommend it to anyone. Mirrors, Stories of Almost Everyone. Let me find another. We've got just about 10 minutes. Let me find a. I've gone through. Here. Origin of Beauty, which just is itself beautiful and has a.
It comes from the same period, the so-called prehistory.
Yes, actually, that's where I fell in love with the book, of course. It starts in prehistory.
Yeah, but it's not chronological. You see that it... No, it jumps.
It jumps.
Sometimes from present to past and from one...
Culture to another.
Culture to another, and perhaps with a secret intention to prove that we may be contemporaries and compatriots of people born far away from our countries and far away from our time. This is called Origin of Beauty. There they are, painted on the walls and ceilings of caves, bison, elk, bears, horses, eagles, women, men. These figures are ageless. They were born thousands upon thousands of years ago, but they are born and born anew every time someone looks at them. How could our ancestor of long ago paint so delicately? How could a brute who fought wild beasts with his bare hands create images so filled with grace? How did he manage to draw those flying lines that break free of the stone and take to the air? How could he? How could he? Or was it she?
Yes. As you said at the top, this book, in telling all these stories, tells the stories not only of the gods, but of those who have been left out of so many of the other stories.
The invisibles.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let me ask you something else and then go back to... I actually teach people nowadays. I teach nonprofits mostly and foundations how to tell better stories, because they have stories, and we know that stories are the most powerful communications tool, I think. It's what brings ideas to life. Talk just a little bit of story. What is a story? What makes a story a story, or makes a story powerful, or makes a story work?
It's the center of a ceremony of communion between the storyteller and the story told, between the reader and the writer, between, you know, it's unbelievable that how powerful a story may be to transmit emotions, experiences, ideas. I know that the world was made of atoms, but it was also made from stories. We are made of stories, and the best way to connect with other people, to share memories and even ideas, is to tell ideas or memories through a concrete story, much more than the idea, see, in abstract terms.
You know, I'm reminded, when I'm speaking to you, I have spent very little time in South America, but I spent a little time in Ecuador, in the rainforest. And at one point, we were like many hours hike, many hours boat ride, and we're in this little bitty village that basically is one man and his several wives and so on. And we are bringing with us the elected head of the Ashwar, who have had contact with the West. And so he's 29. This other gentleman maybe is 45, 50. This other gentleman has lived when it was a warrior time. And when they meet, we all sit silent while the two of them tell each other their stories. And it went on for maybe 8 or 10 minutes of each one of them in this, what almost sounded like a song. This is something that goes very far back.
Sí, historias contadas y cantadas, told and sung, because literature is closely related to music. I believe in the music of languages. And this book is written over a secret river, a melody, making it possible so different, so diverse stories coming from different times and different places because of the Secret River, which is flowing, a subterranean river made of music. I think this is how I imagine the book.
In other words, as you're writing, and it took, I can imagine, years, you're saying that you had a sense that there was a river of song, a river of sound that you were moving through?
Yes. And I certainly do it. Each page I write, as soon as I write it once, twice, thrice, and I get a version that I think is more or less similar to my desire, to what I wish to say, then I read it in loud voice. Because there is a very close relationship between the meaning and the sound. How a word sounds and what does it mean. And then for me, it's absolutely the adventure of writing is very closely related to music.
You know, I was reminded of the little story you tell about the Rosetta Stone.
Yes, also, but it's too long. I know.
But what you say is that the scientist, the linguist who tried to figure it out for years and said it's symbols, and couldn't really crack it, and then finally...
Yeah, finally he discovered the alphabet of the
Egyptians. That
it was
Egyptians. That those pictures were also sounds.
Coming from sounds that had a sound and also a sign. A sound and a sign. And it was a revolution because then the old Egypt came alive. It was like a resurrection of gods and people. And I think this is some of the meaning, the real meaning of the art of writing, even with all that words we recall of God taught.
Right, who said no.
He said no, but I say yes, I believe in it, and I believe in what one of my masters, a Uruguayan writer, great Uruguayan writer called Juan Carlos Sonetti, once told me. He was lying all the time. He said it was a Chinese proverb, but it was not at all Chinese. It was his invention, but it's very beautiful. Look, he told me, I was 19 years old, beginning to write, the only words which deserve to exist are the words better than silence. And in a region like Latin America, which is since the beginning of time suffering this inflation of words, which is more dangerous than the inflation of money, for me, I received it as a very important lesson. The only words which deserve to exist are better than silence. And silence is a language, and a deep language, so it's quite a challenge.
To produce something better.
Yes.
E. E. Cummings has a poem that I can't remember the words of, but it's very much that same thing. He says, all that is not singing, you know, etc. And he said, and the greatest song of all is silence. I'm not getting it right, but it's one of my very favorite poems.
You know, one of the stories here tell also the story of the cover. The cover of the book comes from Nigeria, from Ife, the sacred city of that people who was able to create its beauty, this unbelievable beauty. When these sculptures were discovered in 1910 by Leo Frobenius and other European explorers, they were sure they were Greek, coming from Athens, because Africans could not be able to do it with such beauty. And they ignored that since the beginning of times, African sculptures do their work, carves, singing. And they don't stop singing until the end of the work, because music should be kept inside the sculptures. And these are singing sculptures because they were created while the creator was singing. And this is also something about the importance of music in other arts.
No? Yeah, excellent. We are very much at the end of our time. I am speaking with Eduardo Galeano. We are speaking today primarily of his book, Mirror Stories of Almost Everyone, encyclopedic, poetic. It's a wonderful, wonderful work. And what I'm going to ask you to do now is read the last two selections, Danger in the Night and Lost and Found.
Ah, well, yes. The first is related to airports. I am now, as you know, in a difficult trip, a tour.
A different city every day, a different airport every day.
So many cities. And I am suffering airports, because airports are nowadays, they became everywhere, something like torture chambers. No?
Yes, we run the gauntlet to get wherever we're going.
It's terrible. The day I'm not more able to write, I'll become a stripper, because I have done so many strip teases in these days in the airports. Get off the shoes, off the belt, off the... And I began naked, almost naked. And it was a new profession for my life, for my next life, who knows. Danger in the Night is the first. So two very short stories. Sleeping, she saw us. Elena dreamed we were waiting in line at an airport, a long line where every passenger had under the arm the pillow on which he or she had slept the night before. The pillows were sent through a dream reading machine. The machine detected any dangerous dreams that threatened to disturb the peace. The 20th century, which was born proclaiming peace and justice, died bathed in blood. It passed on a world much more unjust than the one it inherited. The 21st century, which also arrived heralding peace and justice, is following in its predecessor's footsteps. In my childhood, I was convinced that everything that went astray on Earth ended up on the Moon. But the astronauts found no sign of dangerous dreams, or broken promises, or hopes betrayed. If not on the Moon, where might they be? Perhaps they were never misplaced. Perhaps they are in hiding here on Earth, waiting, esperando a nos.
Thank you, Eduardo Galeano. The newest book is Mirrors, Stories of Almost Everyone. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. Email me at temcnally@mac.com to learn how to do that. This is Free Forum. I'm Terry McNally. This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Pacifica for Southern California, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. Thank you, Eduardo Galeano. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. You have been very gentle.